Well, we return again to John chapter 15 today, and we're going to be looking at verses 12 through 17. Last time we finished up the section mostly related to the vine and the branches and keeping his commandments and staying in his love. You're going to see the words this morning as we read these verses are going to be very familiar. They will be familiar because they're in some ways, but not entirely by a long distance, repetitive of words he's used at other points. He keeps emphasizing the similar kind of thought as he prepares them for his departure and for this transition to them leading the ministry of founding the church in the world. So let's look at John chapter 15, beginning in verse 12 and read through verse 17. And if anybody has it, I appreciate you reading it for us.
This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love than this hath no man, when any man bestoweth his life for his friends. Ye are my friends, if ye do whatever I command you. Henceforth call I you not servants, for the servant knoweth not what his master doeth. But I have called you friends, for all things that I have heard of my Father have I made known to you. Ye have not chosen me, but I have chosen you, and ordained you that ye go and bring forth fruits, and that your fruit remain, that whosoever ye shall ask of the Father, that whatsoever ye shall ask of the Father in my name, he may give it you. These things command I you, that ye love one another.
Okay, so, you know, this isn't a beginning point in Jesus' teaching. You know, this is the ongoing time that he's spending with basically the 11. They dismissed Judas again, remember? And he's focusing this time, the last part of the Lord's Supper and the rest of this night on the 11 remaining. And we're getting the highlights from that John has chosen to bring to us out of those moments. And so what we see here is that following this passage about the vine of branches, this next thought he starts with is what? What would you call verse 12? This is a commandment that I give to you. And what is the commandment that he gives? Okay, and he's even more specific than that.
As he has loved them.
As he has loved them. Put that into what you think he was trying to say by this sentence. I give you a commandment, love one another as I've loved you. What do you think he intended the connections, the details to be in the minds of the 11?
Sacrificial love.
Sacrificial love?
Well, the cross.
Well, the cross is certainly coming, and that would be a part of it. I mean, they know it's coming. He's made it clear it's coming. So that's a part of it.
Service is a part of it.
Service was a part of it. I mean, he took care of things with them and for them. What else might you say? You know, if we look ahead to the book of Acts, assuming that they're living this out, the 11, and they were to add Matthias, did a lot. And you see Peter stand up, you see out of that proclamation of truth, confrontation of falsehood, a devotion to God the Father and Jesus as the one path to salvation. I mean, there's a number of things that come out of their ministry to the world. What did Jesus say when he saw Peter after the resurrection and he's there with him? You know, the interaction with, do you love me, Peter? What did he ask Peter to do after they went through their three interchanges on the questioning of Jesus about Peter's love?
Feed my sheep.
Feed my sheep. In other words, I think Jesus is telling them, in the way that I've loved you, I've met your needs. I have, that's a bad way of saying it. I have brought to you the gospel. I have brought to you the truth of who God the Father is. You've seen me, you've seen the Father, brought to you the truth of what grace means, brought to you the truth about what is central to pleasing God. These outward things aren't what it's all about. Where's your heart? You know, and all of these things is a part of how he loved them. He poured himself out wholly on them and the people of this world. And I think that's all included in what he's saying here. You know, love one another might have meant just amongst the 11, but that certainly was going to be a group that would expand greatly on the day following Pentecost. By thousands, it was going to go up.
You're making the connection that Jesus did nothing other than what the Father commanded.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you do the same.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And so, verse 12 says, here's my commandment. This is the central piece. Love one another just as I have loved you. And then he goes on to define it in even a little more detail. Because he defines love in terms of what is the greatest way to love. And what does he lay out as the greatest way to love?
Laying down your life for someone.
Yes. Greater love has no one than this, that one would lay down his life for his friends. And that word's going to become important before we're done with this passage today. But Jesus is saying, here's the pinnacle of love. How does that relate to about what's to happen? That's probably one of the most obvious questions I could ask this morning. Jesus is about to go to the cross, pay the price for their sins, die for sin that he didn't commit, to pay that penalty so they could be not just saved, but sanctified, set apart for the work that God has brought to them, and even be called friends. And we'll talk about that more. Go over to John 10:11 just for a minute, just to remind you that this isn't a completely new theme with Jesus by any stretch. He's been talking about this and talking about this and talking about this. This is just one example of words Jesus used about what it meant and what the motivations are for laying down his life. Somebody's got verse 11 there of John 10. Read that for us.
I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep.
Yeah, he's the good shepherd. He lays out this contrast between thieves and robbers coming to kill and destroy. So what's the implication here of the motivation behind the good shepherd laying down his life? Use the analogy of the sheep and the shepherd. Why would the shepherd lay down his life for his sheep?
Protection.
Protect them. Take care of them. Keep them safe. And so Jesus is saying, you know, the good shepherd is all in on this shepherding business. Whatever the risks are, whatever the outcomes are, whatever it takes, he's going to play his role out as a shepherd. And by good, we mean in the highest order of the, in a proper way, in a way that is exemplary. And as the exemplary shepherd, you know, it's just, there's not thought given to, are these sheep worth it? I mean, frankly, if you work for me and I had a bunch of sheep and I asked you to take care of them, and it meant, and we came to a decision point that either you were going to have to die or we were going to put the sheep at risk, I'd say you're more valuable than sheep. But that's not the mindset here behind what's going on. Was Jesus more valuable than us? Absolutely. But at the same time, this fit the purposes of God, and he, and God, we're not going to go to this passage, but God essentially entrusted Jesus with a gift. And that gift was the people that would follow him. And that gift was given to Jesus, and Jesus gave that gift back to the Father. He kept it whole and intact. And that can be a part of our study sometime in the future. But those sheep were a sacred trust that God gave him, and it included up front the plan that we see here that's about to unfold in the upcoming chapters of Jesus going to the cross. So, if we're to love like Jesus loved, who gave up his life for his friends, how does that apply to us?
Well, you'd consider it two ways. You could always consider it, you know, as far as physical life, but then more importantly, you consider it the time between birth and death, you know, your spiritual life, and the things between now and the time you do die. So basically, that's where your focus is supposed to be, dedicated to those that are glorious.
Okay. Troy?
Basically the same thing. Jesus didn't just die for us. He gave up his life. He, from eternity past, he had perfect fellowship with the Father, and as soon as he became man, he no longer had that in the physical sense, and his whole life was suffering and temptation for us. It wasn't just the cross. The cross was the height of it, but his whole life was laid down for us.
Okay. Yeah, I think to help understand the rest of it, let's start with this point. You know, there have been people who have given up their lives in the mission field. I mean, it was a part of their testimony to literally die, right? And so as we look at those folks, matter of fact, I've run into Steve Saint multiple times lately. His dad, Nate Saint, died in Ecuador through Glades of Splendor. He was the pilot in that little episode. And Jim Elliott was the kind of the leader of the group. And his wife, Elizabeth, you know, became quite a ministry after that. And I'm sure you've heard of her. But I've met Steve Saint. That was fun. Barry, you were there when we met Steve, weren't you?
No, I met him at Piper's Conference.
Okay. But he's at the Shepherd's Conference. What you're going to get a read, a little message from Steve Saint today in our bulletin. So you'll get a chance at that a little later this morning. I saw Steve in another thing. He's basically lived his life with those same Ecuadorian men and the families of the men that killed his dad. As a matter of fact, he was baptized by the very man that actually put the spear in his own dad because he was very young when this occurred. 5, 6, 7, somewhere in that range. He stayed with his aunt. Her husband also was killed in that, and his aunt stayed with those tribesmen that killed the missionaries and spent her whole life ministering to them. Steve has been back and continues to work with them over and over and over again. I saw him this last week. Too much trivia, but I'll give it to you. He's working on a powered parachute that's also a car you can drive, and it's I saw a video of this. This last year he had it at the big flying in Oshkosh, but they're developing it primarily for missions work, and they want to sell enough that they can then take the profits and provide these for missions work in the field. Pretty cool little deal. If you get a chance, I don't remember the name of it, but you could go out and Google it and see a little information about it. But anyway, quite a little car. The car itself looked like fun. Forget about the parasol parachute that they put on it so they can fly about 40 miles an hour as well. But anyway, history is full of those kinds of situations where people give their physical lives on behalf of the gospel, as a part of their testimony, as a part of taking the gospel to others, or just simply refusing to renounce their faith, right? We know that. So what do they give up? They give up their lives. So, by giving up your life, what of this physical world then did you also not give up? Don't you give up everything? I mean, what do you get to take with you? What do you get to retain out of this earthly existence if you die? Well, you know, your possessions, everything, relationships, all of those things come to an end. Now, we have hope for the future. And so on. Don't want to take that away, but so then we could also say, if you're willing to give up your very living, your very physical life, what else wouldn't you give up? Because the rest of those things you would give up if you died. So if you take the logic of this forward, on behalf of our friends, there ought be nothing that we hold on to if we're going to live out this verse and say, well, you know, I'll give you this, but not that, if it's truly on behalf of their spiritual well-being. True? Did I get that right? Did it make sense what I said?
Where would the possibility of recanting our faith come into that? Or am I going in a different direction?
Well, you certainly wouldn't do that. I mean, giving up your life for your friends, people are watching. And, you know, I've got so many things in my life I'm glad you don't know about. Not because I want to have a secret sinful life somewhere, but, you know, we all have this struggle with sin, but the thing that would stand out above all the things in our lives is if, you know, I would try to protect myself through giving up my faith. You wouldn't have much good to say about my testimony after that, would you? It wouldn't be an example worthy of giving consideration to. And so, I mean, that's a part of our testimony to our friends. A part of our bringing the truth to our friends is showing how much it truly means to us that we would even give up our very lives for it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other comments? So, the one thing I do want to say here that I think we ought to say is when we look at this picture of sacrifice, giving up your life for your friends, you know, Jesus is clearly talking about our earthly situation, right? And if we don't see the other half of this equation, I think we would sell ourselves short. What did Jesus gain by going to the cross?
He got to go back to his Father.
He was glorified, back at the right hand of the Father, back making an advocacy when we had need of it with the Father for our protection, taking care of us in that direct link. I mean, he gave up a lot to come and be born as a man and take on flesh and become both man and God. Prior to that, he was only God, became man and God, endured the temptations, did all those things here on earth, but then he gets to go back in a glorified way to the Father and even be given the name among men whereby which we must be saved. So, you know, there's a lot that he actually gained by going to the cross.
He already had that. Already there. So
might be another way of saying it.
Yeah, my way of looking at it is to say he glorified the Father is what he gained. He had the opportunity.
You could say that as well. The point I want to make is when we look at a Nate Saint or a Jim Elliot that gave up everything, children, wives, whatever earthly possessions they had, a ministry they were looking forward to. Steve was quite an innovator. Steve, I'm sorry, that's his son. Nate was quite an innovator in the aviation world. And so he had ideas he was working on that were revolutionary that others picked up. I mean, he gave up all that, but I think it would be wrong to believe that it wasn't of great gain for him to be martyred in that way with regard to spiritually and eternally. And I don't think we ought to leave the equation completely empty on the other side of it, that it should be our greatest goal in life to see the Father glorified and the name of Jesus proclaimed, and that's can be a part of doing that. Comments, thoughts? Did I miss it?
Just have in our the idea of inalienable rights of man, which has always kind of struck me funny, because as you say, even God had no inalienable rights. He gave up his inalienable rights, yet we as a nation have almost come to worship that idea that we have these inalienable rights that God gave us that no one can take away, and therefore, you know, we have to do everything we can to keep those, whereas God himself gave up his inalienable rights.
Yeah, we might say there are very positive things from our perspective on being believing Christians about the great experiment that the United States government's been, but it was still put together by men who were very flawed. So, and we can see that on a regular basis, but still a lot of good things to say about it. Yes?
Before he came to the earth, we didn't know about him. So through his coming, we got to, he got to be pinpointed, mm-hmm. not just a part of God, but the Son. And so then he gets worship as the Son, and also he gets to become our purifier, the one who fixes what we messed up.
Well
stated. To take back what we lost when he gave the creation mandate. And then he allowed it to go ahead and pass from our hands to the hands of Satan, and he gets to take it all back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the other piece that we didn't mention that he gained. I mean, it set in motion. Well, I guess it was already in motion. But it was another step toward that time when he is going to return as ruler in justice and righteousness over this world and rule it both in the millennial kingdom and then in the New Jerusalem. So, I mean, there's a lot coming yet that will be a part of his bringing both order to this world and glory to the Father himself as that ruler. Look forward to having the curse done away with in this world. It gets tiresome, doesn't it? All right. Well, let's move on unless somebody else has another comment there. You know, there, I think we do have one more comment. Go over to Ephesians chapter 3. I'm kind of, this week, got a little bit stuck back in Ephesians more than once. We'll see if we get to the other passage in Ephesians. But in Ephesians chapter 3, verses 14 through 19, talk about, describe the love which comes from Christ. So Ephesians 3, 14 to 19. Somebody read that for us.
For this reason, I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth derives its name, that he would grant you, according to the riches of his glory, to be strengthened with power through his Spirit in the inner man, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, and that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may be able to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ, which surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled up to all of the fullness of God.
Yeah, a lot of in there about the love of Christ and knowing it. Dwell in our hearts through faith, being rooted and grounded in love, be comprehend with all the saints, the breadth and length and height and depth of that love. And he goes on, you know, he just says he wants you to comprehend it, but then he goes on to say, and to know the love of Christ which surpasses knowledge. So when we start thinking about loving in the way Christ did, we really can't put a complete boundary on our understanding of that if we understand what's written here in Ephesians. The applications for that, there's no way we could stop and describe the likely applications in detail. If we have that same love in us that was part of Christ and what he lived out, you know, it would be beyond even full description. I just thought that was a wonderful, wonderful description of the depth, the fullness, the indescribable aspects of Jesus and his love. Other comments? All right, so moving on. Verse 14. So what we so far is he's been giving us the commandment, we love one another, the example of laying down life for friends, and then verse 14, he says, oh, by the way, you are my friends if you do what I command you. And he goes on to say, no longer do I call you slaves. Verse 15 really kind of explains what he means by this. No longer do I call you slaves, for the slave does not know what the master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all things I have heard from my Father I have made known to you. And there's more, and we'll pick that up in a minute. But so there in verse 14, he says, you're my friends if you're the ones who do what I commanded. So what does that mean? What is the link between obedience and the friend being called friends of Christ? Kind of reminds you of the old song, what a friend we have in Jesus. So what's the link between our obedience? Jesus makes a link here. Let's see if we can describe it. What's the role, link, understanding of the relationship between our obedience and being called friends of Jesus by Jesus?
A friend acts like a friend.
What do you mean by that?
Someone who against you and everything you say is not really a friend.
Okay.
The obedience is an act of true friendship.
That makes sense. Barry's got a thought, I can tell.
I don't even want to go there.
Okay, all right. I won't make you.
Like on a physical sense, you could look at it like a catalytic converter in a car. Yeah, the converter causes, it's there and it causes, this is like the obedience thing, and it causes the proper reaction to happen. So the obedience is going to cause however that relationship is supposed to form and happen to happen. Mm-hmm. If it isn't there, it doesn't happen.
Well, I look at it more kind of on the side of, I have maybe two or so of, as I've grown up, people that I would say, these are friends, and I define that by, I believe I could call them up at any point with an issue, and they would be there for me, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you're behaving or performing, I guess, that's probably not the right word, you're acting out in a certain way because of that love, because of that understanding of who they are, and that intimate knowledge of that person, and you do it because you want to do it, because that's your friend.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. You gonna say something?
No, I wasn't. I was
okay.
Just thinking of my covenant study. That's kind of our end of the covenant.
It is. But I think I don't have a problem with some of the tenets of covenant theology or covenant thought process. But if we turn our relationship, and really I want to even use this passage and say this is not what it means a little bit. If we turn our relationship with God into some sort of a contract obligation kind of a situation, we're missing a big part of what the New Testament says. You know, here, for example, you're my friends if you do what I command you. I think there's an element of Jesus saying you ought to focus on doing what I'm commanding. I'm not saying that Jesus isn't asking them to give real clear thought to what are his commands? I want to do them. I know that my relationship with him is affected by my obedience. I want that relationship, and part of my wanting and going after it and seeking Christ is being obedient to him. I think all those things are true, and for us to take anything away from that would be foolishness. At the same time, if we turned it into, I have been obedient in these ways, now he owes me friendship. Or even go to what some folks do with some levels of covenant theology, no, I'm not picking on your study, of laying an obligation on God. I've done my part, now God's obligated to save me. We would miss out even the next few verses coming. And that's what I really kind of wanted to get at was, you know, we don't earn his friendship by obedience, but we pursue the friendship through obedience. Does that make sense? Is that contrast clear enough? And so Jesus is saying, you pursue your friendship through obedience. That's a part of what nurtures our relationship. It's a part of what shows our relationship. And so he's asking them to do that. Go over to 1 John 3, 9 and 10. Obviously, same author, much, much later in his life. And is talking, what's one of the main functions that the book of 1 John can be for you in your life? Seth?
What's a book of assurance, basically?
It can be a book of assurance if you deserve to be assured. It can also be a book of conviction if you have deceived yourself into believing that you're a Christian when in reality there's aspects of your life that might give indication that you're not, or at least some areas of your life that need corrected, because the book of 1 John constantly goes through, if you are my disciples, and then he gives us this measuring stick. And here's another measuring stick, 1 John 3, verses 9 and 10. Somebody read that for us.
No one who is born of God practices sin, because his seed abides in him, and he cannot sin, because he is born of God. By this, the children of God and the children of the devil are obvious. Anyone who does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor the one who does not love his brother.
Yeah, so very similar. We're talking here a little bit different context or metaphor than friendship. It's being children, but it's the same kind of thing. But we get the other half of the equation shown here too. If you're born of God, you won't be a sinner. Now, does that mean you won't do any sin? No, it means that's not the main characteristic of your life. You don't embrace sin. You don't pursue sin. You're trying to stomp sin out of your life. But if you're born of God, you won't practice sin because the seed of God's in you, and he can't sin because it's contrary to this being a child of God. And then he gives us the other side of that. But those that do pursue sin, those that do latch onto it, that's a clear indication that they're not truly children of God. Comments, thoughts? Another passage to look at, Mark 3, 31 through 34. Kind of goes down a similar path. And we'll take a look at this, then I'm going to kind of pick the pace up here a little bit. Mark 3, 31 through 34.
And his mother and his brothers came, and standing outside, they sent to him and called him. And a crowd was sitting around him, and they said to him, your mother and your brothers are outside seeking you. And he answered them, who are my mother and my brothers? And looking about at those who sat around him, he said, here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of God, he is my brother and sister and mother.
Yeah, so once again, Jesus is linking up. It's the family relationship again, but he's counting the contrast between Mary and his physical siblings, half-siblings, and he's saying, you know, my real family are the people that are doing the will of God, meaning the same thing here, keeping his commandments. So just a couple other examples where this is stressed. Comments? Okay. You are my friends if, in verse 14, if you do what I command you. Verse 15, no longer do I call you slaves. And by the way, that is the best translation here. New American Standard got that one right. And we've been through it before. I won't go through it again. No longer do I call you slaves, for a slave doesn't know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all things I have heard from my Father I have made known to you. And so, what's the point Jesus is making here?
We have the knowledge, certainly, to do what he's asking us to do.
Yeah, he's brought the fullness of the things that God has told him and given him and passed it on. You know, if you think about the slave relationship, I mean, you can picture some of the rudimentary slavery things that we might see in the scriptures or see in our own political history. I mean, do you suppose the plantations of the South included the slaves in all the strategies of how they were doing things and what the profit levels were and all that? No. Their job was to get up and go do the task I gave you to do today, do it quickly, do it well, and then let me know so we can move on to the next task. They're not part of the inside circle. In reading about this for preparing for today, one of the things that came up was, and we have something similar in our own government, but the rulers, particularly this was true in Rome, but other kings would do this as well, they would have a circle of people who were called their friends. And that's the same term that was used here. And what the way these folks were used is a lot like the relationship we saw between, if you've ever read about what went on in the Cuban Missile Crisis, Here's Jack Kennedy and a few of his friends. His brother was a key one, but McNamara was there and some others who I don't remember their names. And they're talking about, what do we do about this? We've got nuclear missiles being built right down here off the coast of Florida, and the Russians and all that. And they went round and round and round, and they would talk about a lot of things. They spoke openly and freely. The president asked their opinions. There were varied opinions in the room. Ultimately, Kennedy picked his own path, and they had some very interesting conversations to respond to out of Khrushchev. But bottom line, he had this circle that before he went out and gave military commanders orders, before he talked to the State Department about what to say officially, and all of those folks, these people were the inner circle and were very much involved. They knew what was on the president's thoughts and mind, and he knew what was on theirs, and they considered it valuable to share in that way. And they were the inner circle. I mean, they knew more what was going on than probably is even in the written reports today that we can go read and try to figure out. The same thing was true in this Roman era. Even the emperor in Rome had this circle of people that he would consult with before he went to the Senate or before he went to the military commanders, before he made his decisions that would be carried out. Even though falsely he considered himself and the people considered him a god, he still had these people that hung around him in that way. And that's, I think, what Jesus is saying here by what I've read, that by use of the terms he did, it probably conveys a certain amount of that. As a result of being people who keep my commandments, you get to be involved in the inner circle of thoughts. You get to understand what's really going on in the world. You get to understand and be a part of the strategies. Now, can we quickly say there's an awful lot we don't understand about what God's doing and why he puts things together a certain way and why it takes a lot of faith to live out this life? Because we don't understand Romans 11:33, how the depths and riches of the wisdom of God, his ways are unsearchable and beyond finding out. Yeah, that's there. But at the same time, there are things we can see in this world and understand what's going on. And even in the midst of the calamities that are coming, even in the midst of the struggles, things that are going in the Middle East, we know how God's putting all this together, don't we? If we want to know, it's written right here. It's given to us. Even our perceptions of what's important in the world is different. We get to see the world through different eyes because we're friends of God. And so we're on the inside instead of the outside. We're now part of the purpose. It's interesting, and I looked these up, and I've got a list of scriptures, but really probably wouldn't help all that much to read them. But the people that were called slaves, Abraham, Moses, Joshua, David, Paul, and the list keeps on going, of people who either were called slaves of Christ or slaves of God. And in Paul's case, he even was obviously thrilled to be considered a slave. At the same time, Jesus is pointing out, as a people who are obedient, people who are involved in my kingdom, you move well beyond slaves. And so that puts us at a... It was never said of most of these folks. David had the claim to be able to say that God said of him that he was a man after his own heart. But very few of these folks were ever called friends of God. And yet here is Jesus saying, you are my friends if you do as commanded. It's kind of a privileged thing to be said about you.
Rick, do you think on a practical level this is kind of like graduation day? The rabbi-student relationship is over and now it's
yes.
More of you are my friends and counselors. And
absolutely no question. He's looking at them saying, see yourselves differently. You were the students. You're about to become the teachers. Absolutely, that's there. That's a part of that. Thank you for pointing that out. In verse 16, then, he goes on to say, you did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you would bear fruit. So here's Jesus once again returning to the who chose who here question. But he doesn't just stop there. He says, and I appointed you. Now, what does that mean? How does the appointed add to the word of choosing? Appointment carries with it. Appointment always has an object. Appointed to has to be a part of the sentence. You don't just go up to somebody and say, hey, I appointed you.
To what?
To what, you know? What job did I just get that I had no intention of doing? Is what we might say if it was a worldly appointment. But here's Jesus saying, I appointed you, and there's a purpose to it, and that is that you bear fruit, and that your fruit will remain. What does that mean? What kind of fruit, what fruit in specific, stands out about every other fruit, above every other fruit that would remain?
It will lead to the hearer's salvation.
Absolutely. And if you look, even in the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, self-control. You can go through that list, but those things all have a purpose. And a purpose is that's part of our testimony. That's part of what sanctifies us so that we can be ambassadors of the good news of Jesus Christ, isn't it? And yes, we do want to grow people, you know. And if we go to the Great Commission, making disciples, that isn't just getting them saved. That's getting them saved and then helping them mature in Christ. But all of those things are eternal. That's salvation. When we lead somebody truly to Christ, now get me wrong, it's Jesus choosing when that happens, but it happens through us. When we're a part of that, we have a fruit that comes out of our abiding in the vine that is eternal. And as we nurture people who were saved, that's an eternal fruit.
And so he has entrusted them with the truth.
Mm-hmm.
The truth is the word of God.
Mm-hmm.
And he's about to empower them to go witness for the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't the truth go beyond people? Because God's truth is truth, no matter if there was no people on earth.
That's right.
Way beyond just what we do.
But for whatever reason, God doesn't take it beyond people. I can't explain it. If I was God, I would pick a better avenue than to ask me to be his ambassador. But for whatever reason, God asked me and others like me to be his ambassadors, and he chooses to do his primary work in this world through the testimony of people. There are exceptions. There are exceptions in the scriptures. Paul on the road to Damascus is a clear one. But in the main, from then on, he picked Paul to be his messenger. I mean, he could have, instead of sending Paul to the Gentile world, he could have appeared to every Gentile personally and said, my name is Jesus Christ, and I'm here to ask you to be one of my disciples. That isn't the path he took, and I don't know why. I think it might have been, well, it would have been interesting if he'd have gone that way. But that isn't what he did. And so people are very involved in this as his tools. Comments? Good comments. So there's a result of this in verse 16. I want you to bear fruit that will remain, and so that, or as a result of this, or because of that, whatever you ask of the Father in my name, he may give it to you. And so he makes it clear that he's put them in a position that as they're obedient, as they're seeking to serve him and to seek this eternal fruit that he has set them aside for, that he's chosen them for, as they're doing that, they can be assured that the power, you could almost go back to the vine, that they're going to abide in the vine and out of the vine get what they need, get the power they need, the energy, so that these things are truly done. It won't be flowing out of them. They'll just be the conduit. And so Father will grant their prayers as they pray and ask of him out of this obedience and out of this calling. Now this is interesting, because as we flow our way down through this, he starts out with, I give you a commandment that you'll love one another. And by the way, if you do what I tell you to, you're my friends. And out of that will come fruit, and this is an eternal fruit. And out of that, because of that, if you ask the Father anything, you know, then he's going to do it. He takes them from love one another to power. And you'd think, okay, that's the progression. But as he puts these thoughts together, he goes back to the front end again, doesn't he? In verse 17, this I command you, that you love one another. Don't get hung up on the power, Don't get up in the ability to drop names. Think about that for a minute. Somebody says, hey, did you know that I know so-and-so? One of the guys that works for me, his daughter is traveling around with one of the big name bands all over the world, sets up their work, does everything, can get tickets to any of their concerts, can get you flown in at the band's expense if she wants to. She doesn't do that for her family. I guess she did it once. I mean, and this is it's Grover Cleveland's daughter. This is not a person that you would associate with that kind of a role, but okay, she can drop names. Grover, and I don't know if she's still doing it. That was a few years ago. She may not be with him anymore. But Grover was constantly talking about, you know, she was in Paris and they did this and they did that. And, you know, it's kind of name dropping. See, around somebody dropping names someday, well, my friend's Jesus Christ. You know, the very Son of God, future ruler of the world for eternity. You want to drop names? But that's in here. You're my friends. You're in the inner circle with me. But he starts with love and he ends with love. Our focus isn't on the things that might build up our pride. It's not on the things we might go, wow, look what I've got a hold of. It's love, and just as Jesus loved, give it up. It's sacrificial. It's not about me. It's not about this world. And we're out of time, but I really ought to ask you to spend some time with. So what are you holding on to? You know, where is your obedience to give yourself out of love being kind of held back? And it's hard for us to see ourselves, isn't it? I mean, if you go to the point where Jesus divided the sheep and the goats, the ones that were the goats said, but I did all these things in your name. They really thought they had something to land their feet on. But the ones that Jesus said, you know, you're my faithful servants. I was sick and you visited me. And I go, why don't we do this? And so it doesn't matter almost which side of the fence you're on, sheep or goats, it's a little hard to really see what's going on in your life. And if you're truly, you know, I don't know if I can judge for myself and be very clear about who I am. But it's a challenge worth taking because Jesus put it right at them. Love, just like I've loved you, do this intentionally. Here's the standard. When you do it right, you lay down your lives. So I guess I'll throw that back at you, even though you may struggle to really see it. And I think the answer to this is really in, I've turned too many pages here, verse 16. Whatever you ask of the Father in my name, he may give it to you, including, I think, without a doubt, understanding about where we're falling short on keeping this commandment. And I think if we make that a part of our prayer lives, a part of our seeking out Jesus by desiring to do this, and then going to the Father and saying, okay, show it to me. I probably can't take it, but show me anyway, where I'm coming up short, I think he'll reveal that to us. Questions, comments? Okay, next time we're going to pick it up with verse 18. Let's close with a word of prayer. Lord, it is risky to come to you and to ask you to be a mirror for us so that we might see ourselves clearly, because we so often come up short. And it's painful to realize just how short we fall. At the same time, Lord, when you hold that mirror up, we can also see that you've allowed us to put on the name of Jesus Christ. You've allowed us to be your friends. You've told us that you have paid the price for us and that we are indeed your children. So, Lord, out of our salvation, give us confidence. But out of your word and out of your Holy Spirit showing us the truth about ourselves, show us, Lord, where we're coming up short so that we might be redirected by your Holy Spirit, that we might see the things that you would have us do, that show this love to people around us, that we would love one another just as you have loved us. Oh, the words of Jesus are so precious, and it's in his name we pray today. Amen.